then take up the merit case Tyrone Parker versus Commonwealth, Mr. McCracken. You have 15 minutes. Do you want to reserve any rebuttal?
Let me keep five if I can, Judge.
All right, sir. You may proceed.
Once again, Your Honor, it's a pleasure being here this afternoon. I will note that I thoroughly despise these telephone oral arguments, but be that as it may. Basically, the assignment of error in Mr. Parker, once again, is a question of whether or not he was illegally searched. The search was search of his bicycle, essentially, was what was at issue. His bicycle was searched. The bicycle was determined to be stolen, and based on that, he was arrested, and the evidence actually obtained and sought to be suppressed in this case was the marijuana.
Mr. McCracken, this is Judge Frank. Our first inquiry is when did the seizure take place, correct?
Exactly. I think that the Commonwealth has acknowledged that basically under these facts, if he was illegally detained, everything flowed from a common set of events. So the real issue, I think, at this juncture is, was he detained? Was it ever in illegal detention? The Commonwealth's position seems to be that this, at all times, up to the point in time that it was determined the bicycle was stolen, was a consensual encounter, and that's clearly not the case. We're all familiar with the fundamental test of what constitutes a detention by a police officer. That is, if the individual, a reasonable individual under the circumstances, would not feel free to ignore the police officer and go about his business. Now, certainly when the police officer hailed him over initially, he's riding by on his bicycle, he's called to by the officer, he returns back to the police officer's vehicle. At that point in time, the officer's in his squad car, he's got a partner sitting beside him. When the defendant rolls up on his bicycle, he apparently dismounts or in some fashion, because he's stationary, the officer gets out of the car and approaches him and tells him that basically I've forgotten what the officer said. He was the community affairs officer for the NHRA housing area that he had complaints about the defendant selling marijuana, and that he intended to write him a bar order, and he asked for the defendant's ID, and then completed the bar order.
Do you claim that he was seized at that point?
I don't think any individual. When the defendant came back to the car initially,
you can answer that yes or no real easily.
Yes, sir.
Detained at that point.
At that point in time, I think he's detained.
Thank
at
you.
The point in time, the officer tells him what not when he called him to the car, but when he gets there, the officer gets out and confronts him and tells him what his purpose is. He doesn't say, "Do you mind standing here while I complete a bar order so I can do this official function that I have to do?" He tells him, "Give me your ID card so I can write you a bar order." And there's nothing consensual about that. And
Mr. McCracken, this is Judge Frank. The case law clearly says that asking for ID isn't a seizure.
I don't think the mere ID. This wasn't merely asking for the ID. This was asking for the ID as part of a bar proceeding.
But what is the difference?
Can I have your ID?
Mr. McCracken,
yes,
you kind of took a swipe at distinguishing Jones in a footnote, but that case seems awfully similar to the facts of this case. Matter of fact, Jones seems to be a little go a couple steps beyond in that they asked the defendant to accompany them to the rental office.
That was the whole point. He was found on the property that he was being barred from, and the judge made very detailed findings. There were no detailed findings in this case about consent. On the detention, the judge actually made no findings about the detention itself.
But we review this de novo, don't we?
Exactly. But obviously, as in the previous case we were talking about, where the trial judge makes factual findings, that at least gives you a set of groundwork that you will generally follow, unless it's plainly wrong. In this case, he didn't make any factual findings regarding the nature of the stop. But, again, Jones is not applicable. They are, one, that they were sheriff's deputy in an off-duty capacity. They were on the property in which the defendant was found. And according to the opinion, Jones was specifically asked to go to the property officer so they could go about this process. There wasn't any asking Mr. Parker, did he mind standing there while this officer completed his official function. He said, give me your ID card. I'm writing you a bar notice because of your suspected criminal activities on NHRA housing. That's the nature of the conduct. You can say, I asked for the ID or I demanded his ID. Whatever terminology the police officer wants to use as to how he obtained the ID card, it was clearly, as he stated, to perform an official police function. And he wasn't on piece of property. He's getting out of a marked Norfolk police cruiser. He's got a partner, both armed, both in a uniform. There is nothing consensual about this. I remember in a prior argument where Judge Frank was presiding that he noted that he got a little, nervous and didn't necessarily feel free to leave when the officer was simply looking for a donation to a charity. But under these circumstances, there is nothing unofficial, nothing consensual about this. It wasn't like the officer said, look, I need to write you the board, or do you mind standing here while I do this? None of that happened. There was nothing to convey to the defendant that he had any option but to obey the police officer. And the officer doesn't have to point a gun and put him in manacles to detain the defendant. It's sufficient if the defendant basically acquiesces in the police officer's conduct and stands and obeys his authority. And certainly the police officer was exercising authority, and certainly any reasonable individual under those circumstances would not have felt free to just leave and ignore the two police officers. Now, even if you assume that was a legal function the police officer to do and it was a valid basis to detain him, which is kind of what the trial judge suggested, that this is somewhat akin to being served with process, I disagree with that analysis. Obviously, I think this looks in the nature of having a summons issue. But even if that were the case, even if that was a permissible detention, even briefly of the defendant to accomplish this official purpose, certainly when they immediately proceeded into questioning him about the bicycle, this was a criminal investigation. There was nothing consensual about this. And it basically falls right into the Harris situation. The traffic stop followed by a questioning about unrelated criminal conduct. This was clearly a police investigation. The defendant had received his ID card back. He had not been told he was free to leave. And under those circumstances, whether the initial stop to get the bar order issued was permissible, certainly this continued criminal investigation was not. And no one under the defendant's circumstances would have felt free to just ignore what they were asking him. And one officer's asking him about his bank license. The other one's asking if it's stolen. It's a criminal investigation. And under Harris, basically everything that followed needed to be suppressed. Are there any questions that I can answer?
Does the court have any questions?
I have no further. Thank you.
Mr. McCracken, you have 6 minutes left.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Katz?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Benjamin Katz, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. And to set the table, so to speak, for this argument, I would note that the defendant concedes the initial encounter with Officers Finn and Ortiz in the street were nothing more than a consensual encounter. His argument is, alternatively, either that the barment process itself converted the encounter into an unlawful seizure, or if the barment were not a seizure, then it was wrongfully extended by the officers. And I would submit in response that analysis is flawed, and he cannot overcome the precedent of Jones, which I would submit controls the assignment of error at issue here. And the defendant seeks to distinguish Jones on a couple of bases. One, he argues that it actually happened on the property, that it involved off-duty law enforcement officers operating in a private capacity, and that the factual findings of the court influenced the decision of the Jones court itself. And I would submit that a close reading of that opinion does not bear out those efforts to distinguish. the Jones Court reached its conclusion by applying the Mendenhall factors in the de novo review. It didn't rely on any factual findings of the trial court. And the analysis assumed state action, so there was no basis of the fact that these gentlemen were working off-duty in a private capacity. Rather, it simply applied the factors set forth in Mendenhall, and they found no evidence established the officers displayed their weapon. There was no physical touching. There was no language employed to indicate the person was required to comply. And all of those same factors apply with equal force in the instant case. And moreover, Judge Petty, as you noted, there's a material distinction in that this gentleman, Mr. Parker, was never made to leave the location in which he encountered the police. So again, this is a stronger argument for the fact that Parker was not seized by these officers. I would argue that at no point in the encounter did they indicate he was required to comply, and the analysis to the issuance of a summons is flawed in the respect that he's not been accused of anything. If anything, the barment addresses future activity.
A reasonable person recognize the difference between a summons and a barment notice?
Well, I think the very nature of, I'm going to issue a barment from this property, I think it's clear from the transaction that means don't come back. It's not you're going to get in trouble today. It's if I see you here again, you're going to be in trouble. And I think a reasonable person would understand that difference. And clearly that's what was going on in this case. And Judge Frank, as you noted, the jurisprudence is clear. Simply requesting his identification didn't implicate the Fourth Amendment in this case.
But on that last point, clearly, if the officer said, I'm going to issue you a summons for a criminal offense, no reasonable person would feel free to leave at that point. But
I agree.
What's the difference between that and saying, okay, I'm going to issue you a barment notice? I understand that that it's prospective in nature, but it appears to be an official action on the part of the police officer requiring the defendant's presence.
Well, I think there's no aspect of the barment process that indicates you won't be free to leave afterwards when the process concludes. And I think Jones can stand for that proposition. And there's nothing inherent in barring someone from property that would suggest when we're finished, you're going to have to come with me and your freedom will be curtailed. And, there's simply no evidence that any exchange along those lines to the contrary happened with Mr. Parker. I think it would be unreasonable for an individual in those circumstances to conclude, well, I'm not free to leave. I mean, it is a discrete encounter for a specific purpose that does not contemplate any immediate punishment or consequence.
You think a reasonable person would turn to the police officer and say, no, thank you, sir, and walk away?
Well, I think a reasonable person would not feel like they were required to remain. No, I would argue that a reasonable person would have the ability to walk away, yes. That it would be unreasonable in that context to assume you were being detained, particularly where you were given the barment notice, the language of the notice itself. And it's simply, it cannot be analogized to the issuance of a summons. There's no overlap in the purpose of those two documents. One is, it carries the possibility of criminal consequences, and if you don't sign it, you'll be brought before the magistrate immediately and taken into custody. The other is a warning on paper that, apprises you of consequences to follow if you don't follow the instructions. So I think they are fundamentally different documents with different purposes. And I would resist the argument that a reasonable person wouldn't understand the difference. I think having been given the document and having the language spelled out as to what the purpose was, certainly it was not reasonable to feel like he had to remain, and I think Jones stands for that proposition, and I don't think Mr. Parker's efforts to distinguish Jones are availing. And to that end, in the absence of a seizure, there is nothing wrong with the consent given by Parker to examine the serial number of the bicycle, and so that is the flaw in the analysis of the defendant. There is a break in the chain of his argument, and because it is not a seizure, it doesn't follow that the consent was tainted somehow. I'm happy to address any additional questions the panel may have.
Court have any questions?
I have nothing further, thank you.
All right, Mr. McCracken, you have 6 minutes.
All right, first off, with due respect to Mr. Katz, I think he totally misread Jones. you know, his statement that the court independently evaluated the facts belies the fact that at least on three separate occasions, the court talked about the circuit court's finding. The circuit court, in considering the testimony of witnesses appearing at the suppression hearing, assessed all of the evidence. The circuit court determined whether, under all the circumstances, the counter was transformed from original consensual to seizure because a reasonable person believed he was not free to leave.
But Mr. McCracken, in Jones, the findings of the circuit court referred to in the opinion are all factual findings. The length of time, that no guns were drawn, there's no force of coercion. Those are all factual findings, but the Supreme Court did not rely on the legal conclusion that no reasonable person would have been felt that he was required to remain.
Well, the final language about the circuit court goes on to say, and I'm paraphrasing, the circuit court, after analyzing all the circumstances, observing the witnesses, and making factual findings, concluded that the deputy's action did not constitute a seizure. The record amply supports their factual findings and supports the circuit court's conclusion that it was consensual. Now, there was none of that here. I agree with you. Obviously, you are not to give deference to the trial court's legal conclusions. You are normally to give deference to its factual conclusions. But the problem here, and the reason Jones is very much different, is because at all times there was this element that the officers told him the purpose for going to the security office was to verify whether or not he had previously been on a varmint list. Whether he was trespassing.
Mr. McCracken, what facts are in dispute in this case?
Basically, there are no facts in dispute.
Then
it's a legal proposition.
Why does the trial court have to make factual findings? Explicit factual findings if no facts are in dispute.
It generally does not, although basically the position at trial court was not necessarily that this was consent. The positions have somewhat changed on appeal, and that's all right. That's certainly appropriate. I don't want to overemphasize the factual findings. Simply, there are none here. So you're left to analyze based on the black and white record. In Jones, there was a factual determination that the officers had obtained his consent, and he cooperated to go to the security office so they could ascertain whether or not he had been previously barred from the property. There was none of that here. The officer confronted him. Now, you know, the other thing is Mr. Katz puts a big emphasis on the nature, the difference in a warrant and a borrower. The defendant was detained when the officer insisted that he stand there so he could go through this process. He hadn't received that paper at that point in time. And it was based on what the officer said was criminal misconduct. I mean, the officer told him, it is my intent to bar you from all NHRA housing in Norfolk because I have accusations that you have been selling drugs on the property. That's not about future conduct. He's talking about past conduct, the reason for what he's doing. Mr. Katz is going through, well, any reasonable individual would have understood there was a difference in what was going on. He hadn't received any paperwork at that point in time. The officer was preparing. Nor was he ever actually given a chance, if you look at the transcript, to even read what he was given. They proceeded immediately into this discussion about where did this bicycle come from? Have you got a license? Now, the other part of this thing, even if it was consensual at the point in time he was doing this bar notice, when they got into this investigation about the bicycle, none of that was consensual. I mean, you know, in many of these street encounters between police officers and citizens, it's hard to tell exactly when the precise moment it became non-consensual, but it certainly happened sometime before they flipped that bicycle up on end and started reading the serial numbers. It would be my position that the only initial part of the encounter that was consensual is when the defendant answered the police officer's hail and rode over to the car. Everything after the car, the police officer exited the vehicle, was not consensual. No reasonable individual would have thought that he could ignore that police officer and just get back on the bicycle and ride away. He certainly wasn't told he could. He was never told that he was free to leave at any point. He never was asked if he mind standing there while this officer went through this procedure. This idea that somehow the defendant should have known that he could, you know, that just get on the bike and ride away. When we're in the court, we ignore the realities of what normal citizens go through on the street when they're confronted with a constable. No individual, not an attorney, not a judge, would have ignored that police officer or felt that he was free to do so, given what the officer said he was about and the manner in which the officer approached the defendant. He could have sat in the vehicle and had a casual chat through the window. He didn't do that. He got out of the car.
Excuse me. Your time is up. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you both for very helpful arguments.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you.
That concludes our docket this afternoon.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you again. Bye.